Dr. Taras Kuzio is a British academic and professor of political science at the National University of Kiev Mikhail Academy. He's also an expert on politics, crime, and security in Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. Taras is of Ukrainian descent and received a BA in economics from the University of Sussex, an MA in Soviet studies from the University of London, and holds a doctorate in political science from the University of Birmingham. His most recent book is Russian Nationalism and the Russo-Ukrainian War, which was published prior to the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. He's also an associate research fellow at the UK's Henry Jackson Society think tank and has contributed to the Atlantic Council, Foreign Affairs, Kiev Post, New Eastern European and E-International Relations, and many others. I could fill the whole hour with the list of your accomplishments, Taras, but let's jump into the interview. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. This is a very interesting topic.
Well, we are going to focus on the Russian Orthodox Church. Obviously, it plays a crucial role in Russia's imperial expansion. It's very closely aligned with the Kremlin and with Putin. And I think it's worth unpacking those sort of multiple threads there and how they actually, you know, the importance of that in the attempt to coerce and control Ukraine as well. And then latterly in the interview, we're going to switch to the US and potentially the role of evangelicals in possibly changing the mind within the GOP in the funding that we've seen. But that's two sides of the same coin, isn't it? We've got Russian Orthodoxy, but we also have Russia repressing and destroying other denominations or other religions, such as the sort of Baptists, etc., and Protestants in Ukraine. Where does this come from? Where does the alignment between Russian Orthodoxy and imperialism really find its genesis?
Well, the Russian Orthodox Church origins, as it were, of the current one inside Russia, we can trace back to World War II. It was banned by the Bolsheviks in the as old churches were banned in the 1920s, 1930s under Lenin and Stalin. But Joseph Stalin during the war wanted to mobilize Russian nationalism against the Nazi invaders. And so, of course, he tempered his communism and made a greater emphasis on Russian imperial nationalism. So in 1943, the Russian Orthodox Church is re-legalized, revived as a church. At this time, you've already got an emigre Russian Orthodox Church, which fled during the Russian Civil War and Russian Revolution. So that's kind of separate. But from 1943 onwards to the end of the USSR in 1991, you've got a Russian Orthodox Church, which is an ally of the Soviet regime. But not only an ally, this Russian Orthodox Church is completely infiltrated by the KGB. I mean, this is not something I'm making up or exaggerating even. And the current Russian Orthodox Church Patriarch Kirill it's well known on the internet, has a well-known KGB pseudonym. And so the senior clergy of the Russian Orthodox Church worked on behalf of the Soviet state, in return for which they received, of course, a range of benefits. This particularly was the case both in republics like Ukraine, where they helped to impose the Soviet-Russian system, but also abroad. The Russian Orthodox Church was very active in a number of Soviet front organizations like the World Peace Council and elsewhere, as a way of kind of projecting the Soviet Union as a peace-loving country. I remember going to the World Peace Congress, first time ever being held in a NATO member country, was in 1986 in Copenhagen, Denmark. And the Russian Orthodox Church was very present, much present there, lots of clergy trying to portray the Soviet Union as this peace-loving country, and of course NATO and the West, United States, Britain, as warmongering. This, of course, was a joke because the Soviet Union at that moment was fighting in Afghanistan. But nevertheless, this kind of rhetoric appealed to countries in the what is now called the Global South, then was called the developing world, and lots of these similar types of front organizations were then kind of, you had Russian Orthodox clergy sitting in them, but basically acting on behalf of the KGB. Inside the Soviet Union, more importantly, in terms of what our conversation today, the Russian Orthodox Church was the only legal religious body, religious confession allowed in republics such as Ukraine and Belarus. And because in Ukraine, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church was destroyed and repressed in the early 1930s, the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church was repressed in Western Ukraine when it was annexed by the Soviet Union after World War II. And the Russian Orthodox Church took control of all of these Ukrainian parishes and basically helped to impose the Soviet and Russian system on Ukraine. So this is the kind of monopoly of religious life that the Russian Orthodox Church aspires to today in areas of Ukraine where the Russian regime of the Kremlin has come back and is occupying. So Crimea, Donbass in eastern Ukraine, and southeastern Ukraine. What this meant was that quite a huge proportion of Russian Orthodox Church parishes were actually in Ukraine. And in the Soviet Union, this was estimated at anything up to something like two-thirds, three-quarters. At the time of, in the last sort of decade or so, estimated anything up to 40%+ of the total number of Russian Orthodox parishes were based in Ukraine. So this is a huge number of parishes to lose. And so we not only have religious ideological motives here at play, we also have even financial, because corruption. To put it into context, when Ukraine was awarded autocephaly, which is Orthodox independence from Russia, by the Patriarch of Constantinople in January 2019, Russia de facto loses 40% of its parishes, because parishes begin defecting, especially after the full-scale invasion in 2022. That means that the Russian Orthodox Church is no longer the biggest church in the world, biggest Orthodox Church in the world. It drops down to second place. Romania becomes the first, the biggest Orthodox Church. Of course, that has a tremendous impact in terms of, you know, the ideas of Russia as a great power, Russian influence. Russia always kind of portrayed itself as the leading Orthodox country in the world, even going back to the fall of Constantinople in the sort of 15th century, that Moscow is the third Rome, as it were. We had Rome, then we had Constantinople, then we had Moscow. The key here is to understand that typically Orthodox churches around the world are linked to a country. So, you know, Greek Orthodox Church, Bulgarian, Serbian. In this case, Stalin recreated or re-legalized the Russian Orthodox Church, not as a Russian Orthodox Church, but as a church for the Eastern Slavs. So it's a pan-Russian church. That means that the Russian Orthodox Church perceives itself as the church of the Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Russians. That it believes that its canonical territory is not only the Russian Federation, but also Ukraine and Belarus. So when the Patriarch of Constantinople, his first step in 2018 was to remove Ukrainian Orthodox believers from under the canonical control of Russian Orthodox Church and under the control of the Constantinople Orthodox Church. It gets a bit complicated.
Can we see the roots of Novorossiya?
That was like an earthquake. That's like an earthquake. I mean, you're literally throwing like a nuclear bomb inside the Russian Orthodox Church, because you're saying, sorry, it's over, guys. 600 years of party time is over. Now Ukraine comes under the canonical jurisdiction of Constantinople, not Russia. And then the next step after that was the granting of autocephaly to Ukraine. This was such a massive shock, an earthquake, to Putin that he called an emergency meeting of the Russian Security Council for this religious question. Because, of course, it's not just religion. It's geopolitics, it's control of territory, it's history, it's mythology, it's all of these things together.
And can we link that to this idea of Novorossiya? If it's claiming jurisdiction over, one would assume, all the Russian-speaking lands, all the Russian-speaking peoples, all the areas which Russia considers to be its historic right, then the church is essentially allied with that sort of imperial goal. Or is it impossible to divide, you know, so-called spiritual and imperial objectives?
No, you can't divide these two, because the Russian Orthodox Church views itself as the spiritual embodiment of that pan-Russian identity, which actually was embraced by the Russian Orthodox Church far earlier than Putin. Kirill, the current patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, was appointed in 2009, and Putin began to promote this kind of pan-Russianism when he returned to the presidency in 2012. So in many ways, Kirill was ahead of the curve, ahead of Putin, and Putin has kind of tagged on, of course, doing his own ideological development by looking at white Russian emigre, nationalistic authors, imperialist authors in the white Russian emigres, and also helping to consolidate together, to unite the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, in Russia, and the Russian Orthodox Church in the Russian diaspora. This unity was created in 2007, and what this meant was that the Russian Orthodox Church inside Russia basically was turbocharged on imperialism and nationalism, because you can imagine that if the Russian Orthodox Church inside Russia was nationalistic, well, the emigre one is, it was 100 times worse, because this was basically, you know, emigres tend to be frozen in time, and this was frozen going back to the 20s and 30s, and Russian emigre groups were notorious for their extreme right nationalism, imperialism, anti-Semitism, anti-Westernism. So that came inside Russia, joining up with the two branches of the church joining together. Then Kirill becomes patriarch in 2009, Putin becomes president in 2012, and then the whole show starts rolling. And you have pressure on Ukraine and Belarus to basically reunite with Russia in this kind of pan-Russian nation. The first aggression in Ukraine 2014, that didn't work, didn't bring Ukraine back, as it were, and then 2022. So you cannot divorce the Russian Orthodox Church's support for the what it calls the holy war in Ukraine to recover historical Russian lands, as it's called. It calls these lands in Ukraine historical Russian lands, just as the Kremlin does, and to return to this mythical pan-Russian nation, which, you know, was allegedly born 1,000 years ago in the medieval state of Kiev Rus, and was only ever kind of broken up by foreign intrigue. I mean, this is a key question, that the natural state for these three peoples is unity. And when they're not unified, it's because of, you know, the Poles, the Austrians, the CIA, or the European Union, whoever. And the goal, the ultimate goal, which is not very well, I don't think, quite understood amongst Western experts and policymakers, the goal of the full-scale invasion was to bring this alleged natural state back to life, to bring these three branches of the Russian nation back together. With the Belarusians, this has already happened under Lukashenko, because after the election fraud of a mass protests of 2020, Putin came to Lukashenko's rescue, suppressed the protesters. Lukashenko is de facto just a Russian puppet. The next country was Ukraine. That's obviously more complicated than Belarus. But the goal is the same. It's the goal of the Russian Orthodox Church, and the goal of the Kremlin is to reconstitute this pan-Russian nation in this mythical kind of image that they have, which is based on kind of pre-Soviet, late 19th century historical mythology.
Yeah. In reality, though, that might be the sort of mythology that the Orthodox Church creates for itself. In reality, what are its actual, let's say, genetic heritage? Is it more to do with how Peter the Great transformed and coerced the church and allied it with the state? Do you have to go back to, you know, Ivan the Terrible and his influence? And then you've got the Stalinist influence. I mean, what are the actual genetic roots of the current makeup of the church?
Well, I think that one starting point here to understand is that Orthodox churches tend to be everywhere quite closely associated with the nation state. They're not as independent of the nation state as are the Catholic, as is the Catholic Church or Protestant churches. So Orthodox churches tend to be, or tend to like to cozy up and get into bed with state authorities in most countries. In the Russian case, of course, this is an extreme example. Going back to, as you say, to Peter the Great, who transformed the Muscovite kingdom into the Russian Empire in 1721. And the Russian Orthodox Church became de facto just one department of the Russian government. And that continued to 1917. And then when Stalin re-legalized the Russian Orthodox Church in 1943, again, in a totalitarian Soviet state, the Russian Orthodox Church was again just a branch of the government, or a branch of the KGB, probably more the latter. Under Putin, that's reverted to the same style, that the Russian Orthodox Church has zero independence, and it's just a branch of the Russian Orthodox Church. You can imagine to what degree there are so many members of the senior ranks of the Russian Orthodox Church clergy who were KGB agents or informers in the Soviet period. Could you imagine the number of files on these people? The compromat,
yeah.
Compromat that the KGB, now the FSB, has on these people. And it's not going to be difficult to keep these guys in line, especially as you can also bribe them. You know, I mean, they walk around with wearing watches which cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, the Russian Orthodox Church has never really been an independent institution of the Russians, of the Soviet state or the Russian state. And that has continued. And if you've got a former KGB officer in charge of Russia who has access to all of these files on these Soviet files on the Russian Orthodox Church clergy. So it's literally a pocket church of the Kremlin. And this is clearly seen in occupied parts of Ukraine, where the Russian Orthodox Church comes in on the back of other institutions from the central Russian government, such as the military, the FSB, the teachers and propagandists sent down there. And the goal is, just like it was in, say, West Ukraine after 1945, is to Russify, Sovietize a region and de-Ukrainize it. I mean, this is the same, they're using the same methods as were used in areas of Ukraine occupied after 1945. Ukrainian history, Ukrainian books are burnt or thrown away. Russian teachers are brought in to push the case. Russian Orthodox priests are operating. Protestant churches, Ukrainian, Greek, Catholic, and Orthodox Church of Ukraine. Those three religious confessions are repressed. Their clergy are often murdered or imprisoned, and their properties are confiscated. I mean, this is nothing different to what the Soviet regime did after 1945. And the Russian Orthodox Church has no qualms, no religious moral issues with helping the Russian government in implementing these policies and in facilitating war crimes. So little wonder that when Ukrainian authorities have captured some of these Orthodox priests, they're put in prison because they're actually collaborators with the occupying regime. They're actually helping to facilitate war crimes. Again, this is nothing. Not only do we have the example of West Ukraine with the Soviet implementation of Russification and de-Ukrainization after 1945, but the newly occupied areas of Southeast Ukraine, there the policies are being implemented, which were already made perfect, as it were, in Crimea after 2014, and the Donbas. So the current Russian occupation authorities in southeastern Ukraine have about 8-9 years of practice and experience of implementing the dismantling of the Ukrainian state, Ukraine education, repression, political religious repression. They've already been doing this in Crimea and in the Donbas since 2014. And so they've brought these same policies, which have as their legacy the Soviet policies, they've brought these into occupied southeastern Ukraine. And this is this is a very different style of occupation, say, to what was happening, say, in World War II, because the Russian authorities are not just occupying an area and maybe exploiting it economically. They're doing deliberate policies to Sovietize and Russify these areas and destroy any Ukraine identity in them. And this in turn is an example of what will await the rest of Ukraine if Russia wins the war.
And because the church is embedded in communities, they could be in cities or rural communities, they would tend to know all the people. They would tend to know what's going on, I assume.
Yes.
So does that mean they play a central role in propaganda? Do they also play a central role in basically, you know, creating lists of uncooperative people, whether that is, you know, Baptists or other denominations, or just people who are, you know, more Ukrainian, as it were, or openly expressing? So are they part of that active network of spying and, I don't know the word for it really, you know, denouncing Ukrainian citizens?
They are. And the clergy that have been imprisoned by the Ukrainians have been imprisoned for this kind of activity of being involved and cooperating with the Russian intelligence services in supporting repression and in fingering people, and even in some cases in assisting Russia in military attacks. For example, giving the Russians intelligence about the movement of Ukrainian troops. So they're very actively involved. Propaganda-wise, yes, they are promoting the Kremlin's lines of propaganda and disinformation that the Russian army is not invading Ukraine, it's liberating Little Russia from repression by these Nazis, that these lands are historically Russian lands, just returning to Russia, this is not any kind of occupation or annexation, that there is no Ukrainian nation. This is a fiction dreamt up by Nazis and CIA, etc. There is no Ukraine. Little Russia is part of this pan-Russian nation. We all fought together in the Great Patriotic War. We were all born together in Kiev Rus. Therefore, we should always stick together. Anybody who's opposed to that is a Nazi working for the CIA. All of these kinds of idiotic, lies are promoted by both teachers and propagandists sent and media specialists sent from Russia and by the Russian Orthodox Church. Yes. I mean, it has access to churches and pulpits and meetings. Russian Orthodox priests go around schools. They're promoting this same Kremlin disinformation lying and chauvinistic and imperialistic to denial of the existence of Ukraine and Ukrainians. And they are targeting young people, young children, some of whom are kidnapped and sent to Russia, some are still in Ukraine or sent to Crimean camps, where they're indoctrinated with this propaganda that there is no Ukraine, that this is all a fiction, you're Russians, you're really Russians, you've been deluded, you've been led into this fictional world that you're Ukrainians, in fact you're Russians, and we're telling you what you should be thinking of yourselves. And they use both the Russian Orthodox Church and these various youth groups that have been created, kind of young cadets, young military cadet type groups, to promote this propaganda and this brainwashing of children. And hence why it's so important for Ukraine to liberate these territories as quickly as possible, because there's a danger that how long is this brainwashing going to last? They're also, by the way, recruiting. This is illegal under the Geneva Convention. They are forcing teenagers into the Russian army, who are then sent to fight the Ukrainian army. In terms of the hostility towards Ukrainian confessions, and this is maybe why. One of the factors which has maybe changed attitudes of some Americans who are beholden to the evangelical movement in the US is that Protestants obviously are targeted the most out of all of these non-Russian Orthodox Church confessions, because in the eyes of the Russian Orthodox Church, Protestants are all CIA agents. I mean, this is a fake, this religion should not be in historical Russian land, in Holy Rus. Protestants came as zealous missionaries from the United States. They're all sent by Langley, CIA. And they have often received the worst treatment, even worse than Ukraine Greek Catholics and Ukrainian Orthodox, because they're perceived as literally as American agents. In the eyes of the Russian Orthodox Church, Ukrainian Greek Catholics and Ukrainian Orthodox have at least some kind of claim, or they've existed in this area, but Protestants are a relatively new phenomenon after 1991. And Ukraine had quite a lot of these Protestant parishes, unlike Russia, because they tended to be very successful in parts of eastern Ukraine, where you didn't have much religion, and that was because of the Soviet system. In industrialized areas of eastern Ukraine, there were very few parishes. When I've driven around the kind of war zones of the Donbass region, I'm just stunned at how few churches there are in the villages, compared to, say, other parts of Ukraine where you would get 3, 4, 5 in a small village. And that was simply because of the Soviet system. In newly industrialized areas, they didn't allow churches to be built. And so Protestants often made a lot of progress in those areas because there wasn't any competition from other churches. And hence another reason why they were targeted far more is because they're operating in this Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine, where the worst parts of the war have taken place and where war crimes have been the highest.
And I mean, this is an interesting point because Russian propaganda has been extremely effective at labeling itself as a country of moral values, spiritual values, which has until now gained quite a bit of traction, especially with the sort of, as you say, the more evangelical community. Some of the propaganda that Ukraine is a Nazi state, etc., as absurd as it sounds to our ears in much of Western Europe, this actually plays well or seems to have some traction with large swathes of the more sort of right-leaning evangelical community. That's not to say there aren't exceptions, of course. So how has that happened? But also crucially, as you say now, it seems that some of these actually more realistic narratives and first-party testimony from Christians that actually have repressed by Russia are starting to trickle through into the US. So I'd love to hear your views on that.
Well, I think that the kind of the idea, the mythology that somehow Russia is more spiritually endowed, more Christian than the West, tends to appeal on the far right, whereas the idea that Ukraine is some kind of Nazi-run state tends to appeal more probably on the far left of politics. The issue of Russia as being more spiritual, more Christian, is not that new. The roots of this are Russia's inferiority complex vis-a-vis the West, which goes back centuries. The way that Russia deals with this inferiority complex vis-a-vis the West is by saying we are superior. I remember, as a teenager reading Penguin, I think they were Penguin or in English language translations of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, when in the sort of 70s, when he was expelled and came out to the West, he went to live in Vermont in the US. Should have counted himself lucky because it's a beautiful part of the US. And he was like portrayed as an icon, as a symbol of dissent and opposition to the Soviet system. And then we all got a bit of a shock when Solzhenitsyn started slagging off and attacking the West. The West is devoid of morals, devoid of spirituality. Russia still has these. And this is Solzhenitsyn in the 70s and 80s. So this is nothing new. Putin's just building on this traditional Russian nationalist trope that somehow Russia's more superior, more spiritual than the West. I mean, it has zero basis in reality. If you look at the various indicators of social indicators in Russia, it's terrible. Life expectancy for men, levels of alcoholism, divorce rates, women being beaten up by their husbands.
Which is legal under Russian law. And is promoted by, and it's legal under Russian law and promoted by the Orthodox Church.
I mean, the idea that somehow Russia's more superior spirituality is simply completely based on myth. But of course, this kind of mythology makes them feel better. And when it has zero truth in it, Putin has promoted this, of course, that somehow Russia is a civilization without borders, that which straight away makes you suspicious that this is an imperialistic project if he doesn't have borders. So Russia's a higher plane civilization without borders, superior to the West, the last stronghold of true Christian European identity, because in European Union and in the West, we've gone for disbanding the nation state, globalization, LGBT rights, multiculturalism, you name it, right? But Russia hasn't. Of course, this is all baloney, but it was supported by quite a few people on the far right, including in the US. I think this was a bit exaggerated, though, because where the far right was pro-Russian is not everywhere. In some places, far right nationalists are not pro-Russian; they're anti-Russian. Scandinavia, for example, Poland, Italy. The Brexiteers in Britain are not really pro-Putin, and not everybody on the Trumpite wing of the Republican Party is necessarily pro-Russian. I mean, it's a mixed picture. But certainly this kind of idea that Russia is somehow a last bastion where everywhere else is kind of declining, disintegrating, Russia's the last bastion, it maybe worked better when Putin could take off his shirt and strut around, you know, bare-chested on a horse. But he hasn't done that for quite a while, thank God. So I mean, that kind of thing is... I don't think it's as big as it used to be, maybe 10 or so years ago. And even in places like France and Holland, they've had to tone down, for example, their anti-EU rhetoric because it's not obviously not popular. And even amongst populist nationalists in Eastern Europe, they can rant and rave about Brussels, but they'll never hold a Brexit in Poland or Hungary. So, but on the question of the Nazis, this I think is something that not that many people understand, because many people are new to looking at what's going on in Ukraine and Russia, and they don't have that background in Soviet studies that people like myself, older people have. Really, the origins of this are Soviet propaganda. I mean, it's as simple as that. In the Soviet Union, the Ukrainian, the diasporas from the Soviet Union, the diaspora which was attacked the most was always the Ukrainian. And the next in line were the three Baltic states, Lithuanians, Estonians, and Latvians. The Russian diaspora was never attacked by the Soviet Union. Why? Because it never called for independence for Russia from the USSR. Ukraine was the second largest republic, and its nationalist movement was always quite big. So therefore, they were seen as the biggest threat to the integrity of the Soviet state. Ukraine political prisoners were far higher proportionally in the Gulag than their numbers in the Soviet population. And so this Soviet propaganda rhetoric that you are a Nazi, you're a Nazi collaborator, you're a far-right nationalist, comes from that Soviet background, which of course Putin and the former KGB who now run Russia remember. And so what that meant was, if you didn't like the Soviet system, you were a Nazi. If you don't like Russia today, you're a Nazi. I mean, it's nothing to do with your politics. You can be left-wing, you can be centrist, you can be center-right. If you don't want to be part of this Russian world, this Ruski Mir, if you want to be part of Europe instead, then you're a Nazi. And there's a great quote, I remember an interview with the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, a few months ago, where he was asked, how can you realistically call Ukraine a Nazi-run country when you have a Jewish president? And he says, that's not necessarily a problem. We know damn well that Adolf Hitler had some Jewish blood in him, and Zionists and the Nazis collaborated together in the 1930s. So where does this come from? Well, for two decades prior to Gorbachev, so from the mid-60s to the mid-80s, so the period when Putin is rising up the KGB ladder, as it were, the Soviet Union promoted what it called anti-Zionism. It was its strong support for the Palestinian movement, anti-Israel, support for Syria and elsewhere. And anti-Zionism was de facto camouflage anti-Semitism. And so you can see from that propaganda era how it attacked this alliance, allegedly, between Ukrainian nationalists and Zionists. And they're saying the same thing today, that, you know, Zelensky is just, he's a Zionist basically in bed with Ukraine nationalists. So this is how they explain it. So, I mean, who is that appealing to today? I don't think as many people as in 2014. I In 2014, there were a lot more people openly on the left, including people like Jeremy Corbyn, the former leader of the Labour Party, and others, who was talking about Nazis, you know, coming to power in Ukraine in the Euromaidan revolution. This is all the fault of NATO. This crisis is not nothing to do with Russia's fault. Today, it's far more difficult to people, I think, in the West, or these kind of Russophiles in the West, to openly say that they support Russia, because for obvious reasons, there's a full-scale illegal war and there are war crimes.
And so the lies are more brazen, perhaps, as well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how they get around this by instead calling for peace. But of course, peace that helps Russia. So let's have peace, let's end the bloodshed. Ukraine just needs to agree to give up territory.
Well, the last question is one that looks forward. So essentially, we have Maidan, we have multiple revolutions that transform the political sphere in Ukraine and show that it's possible to push back against, you know, Russian statism, de-Russify your territory, not perfectly, but it's possible to push back against oligarchic interest, which is often very linked to Russia and criminal networks, and a whole variety of ways in which you can take back your country. Very little attention has actually been focused on the role of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church in doing the same for religion and spirituality, to take it back and create a more organic organization rather than a state-run collection of spies and killers, which you've described. Could you quickly say why the experience of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church could be an interesting template, perhaps, for genuine democratic form in some future Russia?
Well, I think there are a couple of differences between Ukraine and Russia on this religious question. Firstly, Russia's it is a multinational country, Russia. There are Buddhists, Muslims, and in Russia, as well as Russian Orthodox Church. But clearly, the Russian Orthodox Church is the favored body of the Kremlin, and it's the body in bed with the Kremlin. And Kirill and Putin are close buddies. In Ukraine, you have you've always had, and this is historically the case, a far more pluralistic religious life, with Ukraine Greek Catholics tending to be more in the West, Ukraine Orthodox spread out in the center and in the southeast, and Protestants in the east. So the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, the church created by Constantinople granting autocephaly in 2019, is a very different animal, as it were, a very different body to the Russian Orthodox Church. The Russian Orthodox Church, because of the legacies we've talked about, is xenophobically anti-Western. I mean, you think Putin and the Kremlin are xenophobic anti-Western? Look at the Russian Orthodox Church. I mean, Patriarch Kirill blessed Russian troops going to Ukraine in the spring of 2022, with one of his excuses being to stop LGBT parades taking place in Kyiv. I mean, this is how you know, kind of backward and primitive and this church is. The Orthodox Church of Ukraine is, in that sense, very far closer and similar to the Constantinople, Constantinople has tried to adapt itself to the modern world. It's far more difficult in the Orthodox world than in the Catholic Church, but even there it's difficult, but in the Catholic Church, but Catholic Church has tried that since the 1960s. And in that sense, the Orthodox Church of Ukraine is far more in tune with European values and far more willing to embrace European values and far closer, shall we say, to Central Europe. And this is because of historical reasons. The Orthodox Church of Ukraine really kind of emerges as an independent institution in the Cossack period of the 17th century. And there its roots are in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. You know, the Cossacks break free of that, but the intellectual roots of Ukrainian Orthodoxy come from that European influence in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. The Russian Orthodox Church lives in a completely different world and has been part of that Russian imperial project, whether Tsarist and Soviet, and now Putinist. So it's we are talking about two completely different sets of worldviews, and when Ukraine will be eventually free from Russian occupation, Ukraine will even more be in favor of moving west, and the Orthodox Church of Ukraine will be fully in support of that, and fully in support of embracing the kind of values we see as normal and 21st century, not the values of the Russian Orthodox Church, which are from the 19th century.
Well, that's fantastically interesting. Thank you so much. We'll have to address in a future episode Ukrainian victory, what that entails, and what we'll have to change to drive back the Russian imperial ethic, or non-ethic, as it were, and reverse that deep historical process. But that's almost certainly for another episode.
I think Timothy Snyder said something very important on this a couple of days ago, and I think it's worth ending on this note, that that we should actually not be afraid of Russia's military defeat, which has been the case dominating the Biden administration in Germany under Scholz. We should actually be embracing it. Why? Because every time Russia has historically been defeated, whether in the 19th century or other times, it's led to reforms. It's led to change inside Russia. It's not led to the coming to power of an even crazier nationalist. It's actually led to reforms and change in Russia. And if you want to see a future post-imperial democratic Russia, Russia's military defeat is the only way to go in that direction. And so hopefully with this new military aid package from the US, and with a new the biggest British military aid package was announced a few days ago, Germany probably will follow now with Taurus missiles as well. This is going to be, I think, a very decisive military campaign this year.
An important place to end on, Taras. Thank you. And of course, if Russian orthodoxy is to reform, that also is contingent on Russian defeat as well.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, if the Putinist imperial project collapses from a Russian military defeat, that inevitably impacts upon the Russian Orthodox Church as well.
Taras, thank you so much. I look forward to picking these conversations up, especially as all these munitions and armaments start to filter through to the front lines. And we very much hope they have a strong effect on allowing Ukraine to fight back and retake its territories. Thank you so much for sharing your views with the audience once again. I know your sort of passion and erudition goes down very well with the audience. So I really appreciate you appearing once again on the channel.
Thank you very much. And look forward to talking again.